As I noted, many of the anti-Castro exiles, veterans of the CIA's various operations, people like Orlando Bosch of the Carew Organization being one such individual, many of those people figure directly in of the Iran-Contra scandal. Not Orlando Bosch personally, but one of his lieutenants in the bombing of the Air Cubana plane in 1976, again while Bush was director of the CIA, was a fellow named Luis Posada Carriles. And Posada Carriles was helping to run the Contra support effort out of Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador. Another member of the Carew organization, Frank Castro, was involved with people like Dagoberto Moises Nunez and Paco Chanes in the Frigorifico de Puntarenas, a seafood company ostensibly, which appears to have been one of the front organizations involved in the Contra-related cocaine traffic. Again, in Florida, bear in mind Henry Krueger's projections in 1980 concerning the Miami conspiracy, and take note of what evolved during the 1980s in Miami and elsewhere in connection with the Contra support effort. Note also the role of Argentine forces in the Internacional Fascista. It was Argentine veterans of the so-called Dirty War in Argentina who helped to train the Contras in the early 1980s. What we're going to look at next is the role of Jeb Bush, George Bush's son, as a liaison person, basically, to the anti-Castro Cuban exile and some of these same forces as they function in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, specifically the Contra support effort. For this information, we're going to turn to Covert Action Information Bulletins issue number 41 from the summer of 1992. Specifically, we're going to take a look at an article called The Family That Prays Together, and that's spelled P-R-E-Y. This is authored by Jack Colhoun, C-O-L-H-O-U-N, who is described. Jack Colhoun is the Washington correspondent for the New York Guardian Newsweekly. He has a Ph.D. in U.S. history, specializing in post-World War II foreign and military policy. And of Jeb Bush's role as George Bush's liaison to the what he calls here, that is to say Calhoun, calls the anti-Castro right, Calhoun writes as follows. George Herbert Walker Bush's second eldest son, John Ellis, or Jeb, was also linked to clandestine schemes in support of the Contras. Soon after congressional prohibition in late 1984, Jeb helped put a right-wing Guatemalan politician, Dr. Mario Castejon, C-A-S-T-E-J-O-N, in touch with Oliver North. Jeb acted as the Reagan administration's unofficial link with the Contras and Nicaraguan exiles in Miami. Jeb was contacted in February of 1985 by a friend of Castejon, who gave him a letter from Castejon to be passed on to then-Vice President Bush. In his letter, Castellón, a pediatrician and later an unsuccessful National Conservative Party presidential candidate, requested a meeting with George Bush to discuss a proposed medical aid project for the Contras. Jeb forwarded the letter to his father. In a March 3, 1985 letter, Vice President Bush expressed interest in Castellón's proposal to create an international medical brigade. Quote, I might suggest, if you are willing, that you consider meeting with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North of the President's National Security Council staff at a time that would be convenient for you, unquote, Bush wrote. Again quoting, My staff has been in contact with Lieutenant Colonel North concerning your projects, and I know that he would be most happy to see you. You may feel free to make arrangements to see Lieutenant Colonel North if you wish, by corresponding directly with him at the White House, or by contacting Philip Hughes of my staff. Interrupting, do you think George Bush was, quote, out of the loop, unquote, as he maintains? This last couple of sentences again. I might suggest, if you are willing, that you consider meeting with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North of the President's National Security Council staff at a time that would be convenient for you, unquote, Bush wrote. Again, quoting, My staff has been in contact with Lieutenant Colonel North concerning your projects, and I know that he would be most happy to see you. You may feel free to make arrangements to see Lieutenant Colonel North if you wish, by corresponding directly with him at the White House or by contacting Philip Hughes of my staff, unquote. Castellón later met with North in the White House, where he also saw President Ronald Reagan. When Castellón returned to Washington for a second visit, he was introduced to members of North's secret Contra support network, including retired Major General John Singlaub and Contra leader Adolfo Calero, Castellón also met with a group of doctors working with Rob Owen, North's liaison to the Contras. Quote, he, Castellón, by the way, it's C-A-S-T-E-J-O-N, was offering us a pipeline into Guatemala, unquote, said Henry Whaley, W-H-A-L-E-Y, a former arms dealer, who said he was asked by his intelligence community connections to help Castellón. Whaley was optimistic about opening a new shipping route to the Contras through Guatemala. Quote, if you can move Band-Aids, unquote, he reportedly said, you can move bullets, unquote. With Castellón, Whaley prepared a proposal to the State Department for the purchase of medical supplies for the Contras from the department's newly established Nicaraguan Humanitarian Assistance Office. The document included requests for mobile field hospitals and light aircraft to evacuate wounded Contra guerrillas. Congress approved $27 million in humanitarian aid to the Contras in 1985. The Castellón proposal was hand-delivered to TGS International Limited in the Virginia suburbs of Washington. Whaley said he sent the report to TGS so it would be, quote, quietly, unquote, forwarded to the CIA. TGS International is owned by Ted Shackley, who was CIA Associate Deputy Director of Operations when Bush Sr. headed the agency in 1976 and 7. Recall, of course, he was also the head of the JM Wave operation, and along with Thomas Kleins, one of the people involved with the Triple Wilson operations around the world. Continuing. And by the way, of course, he was also involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. Jeb had another Contra connection in his involvement with Miguel Riqueri Jr., a right-wing Cuban who headed the International Medical Centers, or IMC, in Miami in 1985 and 1986. Riqueri and his associates gave more than $25,000 in contributions to political action committees controlled by then-Vice President Bush. In 1986, Riqueri hired Jeb, a real estate developer, to find a new headquarters for IMC. Jeb was paid a $75,000 fee, even though he never located a new building. In September of 1984, 2 months after IMC's $2,000 contribution to the Dade County Republican Party, which was headed by Jeb, the vice president's son contacted several top HHS, Department of Health and Human Services, officials on behalf of IMC. Quote, contrary to rumors, Riqueri was a good community citizen and a good supporter of the Republican Party, unquote, one official of the HHC remembered Jeb telling him in late 1984. Jeb successfully sought an HHS waiver of a rule so that IMC could receive more than 50% of its income from Medicare. Leon Weinstein, W-E-I-N-S-T-E-I-N, an HHS Medicare fraud inspector, worked on an audit of IMC in 1986. He is charged that IMC used Medicare funds to treat wounded Contras at its hospital. The transaction was arranged by IMC official Jose Basulto, B-A-S-U-L-T-O, a right-wing Cuban trained by the CIA, who arranged for Contras to receive treatment in Miami. Basulto was praised for his commitment by Felix Rodriguez. Quote, he has been active for a decade in supporting the Nicaraguan freedom fighters ever since the Sandinistas took power, and is constantly organizing Contra support among Miami's Cuban community. He has even been to Contra camps in Central America, helping to dispense humanitarian aid, unquote. And skipping down, Riqueri's links to the mafia also raised eyebrows in Washington. Quote, as far back as the 1960s, he had ties with reputed racketeers who had operated out of pre-Castro Cuba, and who later forged an anti-Castro alliance with the CIA, unquote, the Wall Street Journal reported. The journal added that the late Santos Traficante Jr., the mafia boss of Florida, quote, helped out when Riqueri needed business financing, unquote. Traficante, a major drug trafficker, joined a failed CIA effort to assassinate Cuban President Fidel Castro in the early 1960s. So again, behold the evolution of this milieu. We began with the material from Henrik Krüger by taking a look at Krüger's correct, in my opinion, fingering of the importing of the Galen organization and its Vlasov contingent as the main element in the origins of this particular milieu, this fascist international that we're looking at. We saw its evolution up through the Bay of Pigs, the various anti-Castro Cuban operations, the assassination of John Kennedy, and its evolution and the evolution of many of its players on up into the fascist international that we've been looking at, an organization whose waters lap on many shores, including obviously that of elements of U.S. intelligence, elements of the residua of the Nazi Party in exile in Spain, the SS underground in Latin America, including Colonia Dignidad, and obviously among the shores that these waters wash upon are the shores of George Bush and company, unquote. Still more about Jeb and his functioning as liaison to the anti-Castro Cuban community. By the way, of course, we looked into Santos Trafficante in Radio Free America number 24. We also took a look at his activities in The Guns of November Part 1 and his discussion with an anti-Castro, with a Cuban exile named Jose Alemán. Alemán expressed the viewpoint, his opinion, that President Kennedy would be reelected, and Santos Trafficante said, no, Jose, he is going to be hit. Trafficante declined to testify before a congressional, or declined to give substantive testimony before a congressional committee. Now, one of the functions that Jeb Bush performed as a liaison between his father and the anti-Castro Cuban community in Miami was his lobbying on behalf of the release of Orlando Bosch. Now, remember, Orlando Bosch was the head of the Carew organization, elements of which evolved into the Internacional Fascista, elements of which, or graduates of which, such as Frank Castro, were involved with the Contra support effort. One of the people involved in the bombing of the Air Cubana plane in 1976, again when George Bush was head of the CIA. One of his compatriots was a fellow named Luis Posada Carriles, again a major functionary in the Contra support effort being run out of Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador. Of Jeb Bush's efforts on behalf of Orlando Bosch, Calhoun writes as follows. Anti-Castro terrorist Orlando Bosch was paroled in 1990 after Jeb lobbied the Bush administration for his release from prison in Miami. Bosch had been jailed in 1988 for jumping bail on a 1968 conviction for shooting a bazooka at a Polish freighter in the Miami harbor. He is better known as the mastermind of the explosion of a Cuban commercial airliner over Barbados on October 5, 1976, in which 73 passengers were killed. A U.S. District Court judge revealed in 1988 that secret U.S. documents concluded Bosch was a leader of the Coordination of United Revolutionary Organizations, or CARU, which was responsible for more than 50 anti-Castro bombings in Cuba and elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere. And again, I think Calhoun has appropriately entitled his article, The Family That Prays Together, P-R-E-Y. And again, the central focus of this discussion has been to look at the evolution of the U.S. national security state, to take a look at how it has evolved as, how elements of it have evolved as a section of this fascist international. And one of the things that has led to the fundamental corruption of American democracy, not just the political assassinations in the United States, but the necessity of covering up the manifest crimes of this national security state functioning in conjunction with this fascist international. It has become necessary in the name of, quote, national security to cover up so much of this information, and that covering up has corrupted not only our judicial process, but also our flow of information as well. One of the main ways in which the evolution of the U.S. national security state, in conjunction with the elements that I have been examining over the course of the, we have been examining over the course of the last 3 months in this massive archive show, one of the things that has been central to the evolution of fascism in America has been the need to corrupt, or the perceived need, the need on the part of the elements we're discussing, to corrupt the basic elements of American democracy in order to protect their own misdeeds and also to further their own ends. One of the things that anti-fascist writer George Seldes observed, and he observed the rise of fascism in Europe in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, was that one of the things that ultimately pushes an emerging fascist society over the brink, so to speak, one of the things that compels the complete elimination of human freedom and all vestiges of democracy in a fascist country is the need on the part of the criminalized government to eliminate all vestiges of democracy and justice in order to preserve the secrecy of its own fundamental criminality. And one of the things which has helped to bring fascism to America, one of the things that has absolutely corrupted this country, has been the need on the part of the national security state to preserve secrecy and to corrupt the journalistic environment of the country, as well as the legal environment of the country, not to mention the political environment that has been corrupted by so many of the covert operations conducted in the U.S., ranging from, for example, the assassination of John Kennedy to the apparent October surprise deal. We're going to look at, during the last few minutes of the program, one of the things that is most disgusting to me as someone involved in the media, and that is the corruption of the journalistic process, the corruption of the media, as well as the corruption of governmental institutions per se, as a result of the national security state's perpetuation of, or the, its need to perpetuate the secrecy for its various scams. And again, the evolution of the U.S. national security state, or its dominant elements, in connection with this fascist international is what we've been looking at. In reality, the functions of that state represent the fundamental focus of all of the archive shows for the 13 plus years that I've been on the air. I've enumerated some of the many shows: The Guns of November, the first three Radio Free America shows, 14, 15, 17 through 21, 22, 26 through 31, all go into the many of the things that I've touched on in the broadcast this evening, but obviously due to the limitations of space and time, I cannot go into all of those things in the detail that they demand. I've pretty much done that in the past. We're going to take a look at an op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, October 5th of 1992. This is a column called Open Forum. It's authored by Saul Landau, the co-author of the book Assassination on Embassy Row, along with John Dinges, that implicates George Bush directly in the cover-up of the assassination of Orlando Letelier, again, an Operation Condor/International Fascista killing, aided and abetted, obviously, by elements of U.S. intelligence, with George Bush ruling the roost, so to speak. And this particular column, I think, goes right to the core of one of the major ways in which the national security state has corrupted American society, and one of the things that has brought us to the evolving fascist state that we are. And again, one of what we're looking at as we wind down RFA 37, as we are looking at the effects on American society of how the the U.S. losing the Second World War. Reading part of Landau's column again, Chronicle 10-5-92. It's entitled, U.S. Government Secrecy is America's Achilles Heel. And it reads in part as follows. The Democratic attack team, hoping to offset Bill Clinton's draft status problems, is elated over revelations that President Bush lied about his knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair. Howard Teicher, T-E-I-C-H-E-R, a former national security official, told Nightline on September 24th that in 1986, Vice President Bush was briefed on the details of the Iran-Contra shenanigans. But the issue isn't really about whether or not Bush is lying or whether Clinton was a draft dodger. The real issue transcends both the current campaign and the questions of what Bush knew and when. Scandals of our era have revealed the Achilles heel of contemporary American democracy. Secrecy that is protected by a secret apparatus operating on a track parallel with, or at cross purposes to the legitimate government. With each scandal, we discover that a national security elite, quote, classified, unquote, information to cover up shady business. Indeed, national security logic would lead us to believe that Iran-Contra documents are secret because revealing them compromises U.S. security. But who is at risk when the public learns of Bush's participation in allegedly criminal conversations with other cabinet members in 1986? From the late 1940s, national security emerged as a murky doctrine that justified the creation of powerful new agencies, agencies that presumed a permanent state of crisis. National security officers replaced openness with secrecy, routine accountability to government workings became restricted, and bureaucrats found endless, quote, threats, unquote, to convince Congress to renew their budgets. National security ideologues released reams of documents to justify ever more expensive weapon systems. In the 1980s, as the Soviet Union atrophied, they assured the president that the enemy was more powerful than ever. So we got new bombers, nuclear subs, land-based missiles, and Star Wars, quote, minority, unquote, intelligence reports that indicated near collapse in Moscow, eluded decision-makers, and, of course, the public. Occasionally, such dissent, quote, leaked, unquote, through the membranes of the concealed government, and panic resulted. I think that very nicely summarizes how the national security state has corrupted American society, or how the dominant elements have, and how that has led in many ways to fascism in America. Vis-a-vis the classification of information to protect the national security state, let's turn now to the New York Times of Thursday, September 10th of 1992. This is a story by Ralph Blumenthal of the New York Times. It's headlined, CIA Planning to Unlock Many Secret Files on Nazis. It reads in part, in a change of policy that could provide new information about American recruitment of Nazi war criminals after World War II, the Central Intelligence Agency said it has begun to systematically research its records with the aim of opening long secret files to historian scrutiny. The agency, which has been accused of shielding such contacts in the past, said it intended to make public the information so long as it did not harm national security, regardless of its potential for embarrassment to the government. And I would interject, if you believe that, I've got a great deal on some swampland in Florida, near Miami, as a matter of fact, formerly owned by Karoo, that I will sell you. That's an attempt at dark humor on my part. Skipping down to the last paragraph of this particular article, we're going to see the new, quote, openness, unquote, of the CIA. The other man that the CIA said it had found no record of is Mykola Lebed, L-E-B-E-D, a Ukrainian emigre identified in a 1985 report by the United States General Accounting Office as a Nazi collaborator and terrorist who, it said, had been sentenced to death in Poland in 1934 for plotting an assassination. The GAO report said that the CIA had taken him to the United States in about 1948 and arranged for his permanent residency under a law allowing it to bring in 100 people a year without regard to normal eligibility. So the CIA claims it has no files on Mykola Lebed. Let's see what we can find out about Mykola Lebed. Obviously, we cannot turn to the CIA files. What we are going to turn to is a book we have utilized at great length in RFA 37. That book is called Blowback, subtitled The First Full Account of America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Disastrous Effect on Our Domestic and Foreign Policy, authored by Christopher Simpson, published in hardcover by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, copyright 1988. And Mykola Lebed is dealt with at great length in Blowback, part of the account of Lebed's activities as follows. The convicted assassin Mykola Lebed emerged after the war as one of the United States' most important agents inside the OUN-UPA. Of course, that's the group of which Stefan Bandera was a main element. Continuing, his case is of interest here because it illustrates the manner in which the CIA recruited Nazi collaborators after the war and how it smuggled a number of the top leaders of the OUN-UPA into the United States. As noted above, Lebed entered the Gestapo's training school in Krakow in 1939. The Yad Vashem archives in Jerusalem contain a detailed description of Lebed's activities at that center that was provided by Mikta Koskayevsky, a former OUN functionary who worked under Lebed's command at Krakow, but who broke with him after the war. As Koskivitsky tells it, Lebed personally led the torture and murder of captured Jews at Krakow as a means of, quote, hardening, unquote, his men against bloodshed. By the way, that man's name, M-Y-K-Y-T-A, K-O-S-A-K-I-V-S, apostrophe K-Y-Y. Continuing, Lebed himself acknowledges that he was active in the Gestapo center, but denies he took part in torture or murder. According to U.S. Army intelligence records obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, the OUN appointed Lebed, quote, Home Secretary and Police Minister, unquote, in the Nazi Quisling government of Lvov, the temporary capital of the Ukraine during the German invasion in 1941. Of course, Theodor Oberlander led the Einsatzgruppe in Nachtigall that liquidated the Jewish population of Lvov. We looked at that last week. Skipping down, of the activities in Lvov under the stewardship of Oberlander and company, including Mykola Lebed, Ukrainian nationalist propaganda whipped the population into a fury against Jews and anyone suspected of communist sympathies. Police and militia forces, presumably under the command of the police minister Mykola Lebed, remained busy day and night with mass roundups of unarmed men and women, public hangings, beatings, and other abuse. Lvov's Jews were arrested, tortured, and shot in large numbers by both OUN troops and Nazi Einsatzkommando murder squads. Quote, Long live Adolf Hitler and OUN leader Stepan Bandera, unquote, was among the most popular slogans, according to eyewitnesses. Again, quoting, Death to the Jews and the Communists, unquote. The killings of these people during the first weeks after the German invasion must have seemed almost carnival-like to some. They were a drunken orgy of violence and a celebration of newly seized power. Resistance was crushed through open terror. OUN police and militiamen raped Polish and Jewish women with impunity. Polish professors were rounded up, beaten, then executed, and Ukrainian nationalist extremists assisted in mass executions of Jews near the gas works on the outskirts of town. At least 7,000 unarmed Jewish men and women were rounded up and executed in the weeks that followed, according to Nazi Einsatzgruppen reports, and this number does not include those who were shot or beaten to death during civilian pogroms. So obviously Mykola Lebed, functioning in conjunction with people like Theodor Oberlander and the Einsatzgruppe in Nachtigall. The last installment in tonight's segment, or the last element in tonight's installment of RFA 37, would be absolutely worthy of George Orwell and 1984. Nothing, I think, illustrates the corruption of American society by the national security state, the effect on the U.S. of having lost the Second World War, than this following article in the Washington Post, specifically the Washington Post, and a listener who sent this to me did not have the date on here. Well, I'll have the date for you next week. It's from earlier in 1992, and I will have the precise date for you next week. I have a Chronicle copy of this very same article. But in any event, research credit on this goes to a listener. This is a Washington Post story from early 1992. I believe it is from April of 1992. I will double check that. Actually, this is April 23rd of 1992. This is an article by George Lardner Jr. of the Washington Post. I'm only going to read part of it. And in a truly Orwellian headline and development, the article is headed, CIA report on openness classified secret. When CIA Director Robert M. Gates publicly promised, quote, a greater openness and sense of public responsibility, unquote, at the intelligence agency a few weeks ago, he was acting on the recommendations of a special task force that had studied ways to make the agency more visible, credible, and responsive to the outside world. But when the 15-page, quote, task force report on greater CIA openness was submitted to Gates December 20th, it was stamped, quote, secret, unquote, a classification formally reserved for information, quote, the unauthorized disclosure of which reasonably could be expected to cause serious damage to the national security, unquote. Skipping down on the story, of the Public Affairs Office of the CIA, the article goes on to write, the task force, headed by then CIA Public Affairs Director Joseph Detrani, capital D-E, capital T-R-A-N-I, also touted what it saw as the accomplishments of the agency's existing media program. Quote, PAO now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation, unquote, the report said. That these last sentences again. PAO now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation, unquote, the report said, again quoting, this has helped us turn some intelligence failure stories into intelligence success stories, and it has contributed to the accuracy of countless others. I think the word accuracy belongs in quotes here. Again, quoting, in many instances, the report continued, again quoting, we have persuaded reporters to postpone, change, hold, or even scrap stories that could have adversely affected national security interests or jeopardized sources and methods. I think people like Gerhard Hartmut von Schubert and Werner Naumann and Alfred Gielen and Eberhard Taubert, other people we've talked about in RFA 37, all veterans of Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry, would be very, very proud of what their activities and their legacy has generated in the United States, in the U.S. And although it says every major wire service here, I think by extension, many of these so-called alternative media can be seen in this same light. The Oliver Stone film and about JFK and the fury that it generated and the journalistic firing squad, including the so-called alternative media, note the use of the term so-called, I think bears stark witness to the accuracy of this statement. PAO now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation. Again, Gerhard Hartmut von Schubert, Eberhard Taubert, Alfred Gielen, Werner Naumann, they would be very, very proud. And nothing illustrates, at least to me, the extent to which the United States lost the Second World War than this. Not that there has not always been fudging by the press. Much of George Seldes' work on the press, the Lords of the Press, You Can't Print That, Tell the Truth and Run, goes into that. But the growth of the national security state has made it an established national policy. And again, I think this article with the Orwellian headline, CIA Report on Openness, Classified Secret, illustrates about as effectively as anything I could think of how the U.S. lost the Second World War. We'll put a wrap on the program next week, and we will hit the ground running, and we will move right up into current news stories next week. And this concludes this installment of Radio Free America 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War.